they could cure. Both Sophie and Gabriel had assisted him to his room, though he protested the whole way that all available attention should go to Jem.
"Do not go in there," Gabriel said in a low voice. "They are trying to save Jem. Your brother needs to be there for him."
"Be there for him? What can he do? Well, he's not a doctor."
"Even unconscious, James will draw strength from his parapetai. I need to talk to Will for only a moment."
Gabriel ran his hands through his mop of tousled hair.
"You have not been with the Shadow Hunters very long," he said. "You may not understand.
To lose your parapetai, it is no small thing. We take it as seriously as losing a husband or wife, or a brother or sister. It is as if it were you lying in that bed."
"Will would not care so much if I were lying in that bed."
Gabriel snorted. "Your brother would not have taken so much trouble to warn me off you if he did not care about you, Miss Herondale."
"No, he does not like you much."
"Why is that? Why are you giving me advice about him now? You did not like him either."
"No," Gabriel said. "It is not quite like that. I do not like Will Herondale. We have disliked each other for years. In fact, he broke my arm once."
"Did he?"
Cecily's eyebrows shot up despite herself. "And yet I am beginning to come to see that many things that I have always thought were certain are not certain. And Will is one of those things. I was certain he was a scoundrel, but Gideon has told me more about him, and I begin to understand he has a very peculiar sense of honour."
"And you respect that?"
"I wish to respect it. I wish to understand it. And James Carstairs is one of the best of us. Even if I hated Will, I would want him spared now, for Jem's sake."
"The thing I must tell my brother," Cecily said.
"Jem would want me to tell him. It is important enough, and it will take but a moment."
Gabriel rubbed the skin at his temples. He was so very tall. He seemed to tower above Cecily. For all that, he was very slender. He had a sharply planed face, not quite pretty, but elegant, his lower lip shaped nearly exactly like a bow.
"All right," he said. "I will go in and send him out."
"Why you, and not me?"
"If he is angry, if he is grief-stricken, it is better I see it, and that he be furious with me than you," Gabriel said matter-of-factly. "I am trusting you, Miss Herondale, that this is important. I hope you won't disappoint me."
Cecily said nothing, just watched as Gabriel pushed the door of the sick room open and went in. She leaned against a wall, her heart pounding, as a murmur of voices came from within. She could hear Charlotte say something about blood replacement rooms, which were apparently dangerous, and then the door opened and Gabriel came out. She stood up straight.
"Is Will?"
Gabriel's eyes flashed at her, and a moment later Will appeared on Gabriel's heels, reaching around to shut the door firmly behind him. Gabriel nodded at Cecily and set off down the hall, leaving her alone with her brother. She had always wondered how you could be alone with someone else, really. If you were with them, weren't you by definition not alone? But she felt entirely alone now, for Will seemed to be somewhere else completely. He did not even seem to be angry. He leaned against the wall by the door beside her, and yet he seemed as insubstantial as a ghost.
"Will," she said.
He did not seem to hear her. He was trembling, his hands shaking with strain and tension.
"Quillamoyne," she said again more softly.
He turned his head to look at her at least, though his eyes were as blue and cold as the water of Glenmungi in the lee of the mountains.
"I first came here when I was 12,
he said.
"I know,"
Cecily said, bewildered. Did he think she could have forgotten? Losing Ella and then her Will, her beloved older brother, in only a matter of days. But Will did not even seem to hear her.
"It was, to be precise, the 10th of November of that year. And every year after, on the anniversary of that day, I would fall into a black mood of despair. That was the day, that my birthday, when I was most strongly reminded of Mam and Dad and of you. I knew you were alive, that you were out there, and that you wanted me back, and I could not go. Could not even send you a letter. I wrote you dozens, of course, and burned them. You had to hate me and blame me for Ella's death."
"We never blamed you."
After the first year, even though I still dreaded the day's approach, I began to find that there was something Jem simply had to do every November 10th. Some training exercise or some search that would take us to the far end of the city in the cold, wet winter weather. And I would abuse him bitterly for it, of course. Sometimes the damp chill made him ill, or he would forget his drugs and become ill on the day, coughing blood and confined to bed. And that would be a distraction too. And only after it had happened 3 times, for I am very stupid, Cessy, and think only of myself, did I realize that of course he was doing it for me. He had noticed the date and was doing all he could to draw me away from my melancholy. Cecily stood stock still, staring at him. Despite the words that pounded in her head to be spoken, she could say nothing, for it was as if the veil of years had fallen away, and she was seeing her brother at last, as he had been as a child, petting her clumsily when she was hurt, falling asleep on the rug in front of the fire with a book open on his chest, climbing out of the pond laughing and shaking water out of his black hair. Will, with no wall between himself and the world outside. He put his arms about himself as if he were cold. "I do not know who to be without him," he said. "Tessa is gone, and every moment she is gone is a knife ripping me apart from the inside. She is gone, and they cannot track her, and I have no idea where to go or what to do next, and the only person I can imagine speaking my agony to is the one person who cannot know, even if he were not dying." "Will, Will," she put her hand on his arm, "please listen to me. This is about finding Tessa. I believe I know where Mortmain is." His eyes snapped wide at that. "How could you know?" "I was close enough to you to hear what Jessamine said when she was dying," Cecily said, feeling the blood pounding in him under his skin. His heart was hammering. "She said you were a terrible Welshman."
"Jessamine?"
He sounded bewildered, but she saw the slight narrowing of his eyes. Perhaps unconsciously, he was beginning to follow the same line of thought she had.
"She kept saying Mortmain was in Idris, but the Cleave knows he is not," said Cecily rapidly. "You did not know Mortmain when he lived in Wales, but I did. He knows it well, and once you did too. We could open the shadow of the mountain, Will. Think."
He stared at her.
"You don't imagine.
Cadar Idris."
"He knows those mountains, Will," she said, "and he would find it all funny, a great joke on you and all the Nephilim. He has taken her exactly where you fled from. He has taken her to our home."
"A posset," said Gideon, taking the steaming mug from Sophie. "I feel like a child again."
"It has spice and wine in it. It'll do you good. Build up your blood."
Sophie fussed about, not looking at Gideon directly, as she set the tray she had been carrying down on the nightstand beside his bed. He was sitting up, one of the legs of his trousers cut away below the knee and the leg itself wrapped in bandages. His hair was still disarrayed from the fight, and though he had been given clean clothes to wear, he still smelled slightly of blood and sweat.
"These build up my blood," he said, holding out an arm on which 2 blood replacement runes, Sanglier's, had been inked.
"Is that supposed to mean that you don't like possets either?" she demanded, her hands on her hips. She could still recall how annoyed she'd been with him about the scones, but she had forgiven him completely the night before while reading his letter to the consul, which she had not had a chance to post yet. It was still in the pocket of her blood-stained apron. And today, when the automaton had sliced at his leg on the institute steps and he'd fallen, blood pouring from the open wound, her heart had seized up with a terror that had surprised her.
"No one likes possets," he said with a faint but charming smile.
"Do I have to stay and make sure you drink it, or are you going to throw it under the bed? Because then we'll have mice."
He had the grace to look sheepish. Sophie rather wished she had been there when Bridget had swept into his room and announced that she was there to clean the scones out from under the bed.
"Sophie," he said,
and when she gave him a stern look, he took a hasty swig of the posset.
"Miss Collins, I have not yet had a chance to properly apologize to you, so let me take it now. Please forgive me for the trick I played on you with the scones. I did not mean to show you disrespect.
I hope you do not imagine I think any less of you for your position in the household, for you are one of the finest and bravest ladies I have ever had the pleasure of knowing. Sophie took her hands off her hips. Well, she said, it was not many gentlemen who would apologize to a servant. That is a very pretty apology, and I am sure the scones are very good, he added hastily. I just don't like scones. I've never liked scones. It's not your scones. Do please stop saying the word scone, Mr. Lightwood. All right. And they are not my scones. Bridget made them. All right. And you are not drinking your posset. He opened his mouth, then shut it hastily and lifted the mug. When he was looking at her over the rim, she relented and smiled. His eyes lit up. Very well, she said. You do not like scones. How do you feel about sponge cake? It was mid-afternoon, and the sun was high and weak in the sky. A dozen or so of the Enclave Shadow Hunters and several Silent Brothers were spread out across the property of the Institute. They had taken away Jessamine earlier, and the body of the dead Silent Brother, whose name Cecily had not known. She could hear voices from the courtyard and the clank of metal as the Enclave sifted through the remnants of the automaton attack. In the drawing room, however, the loudest noise was the ticking of the grandfather clock in the corner. The curtains were drawn back, and in the pale sunlight, the consul stood scowling, his thick arms crossed over his chest.
"This is madness, Charlotte," he said. "Utter madness, and based on the fancy of a child."
"I am not a child," Cecily snapped. She was seated in a chair by the fireplace, the same one Will had fallen asleep in the night before. Had it been such a short time ago? Will stood beside her, glowering. He had not changed his clothes. Henry was in Jem's room with the Silent Brothers. Jem had still not regained consciousness, and only the arrival of the consul had dragged Charlotte and Will from his side. "And my parents knew Mortmain, as you well know. He befriended my family and my father. He gave us Ravenscar Manor when my father had... when we lost our house near Doggerthigh." "It is true," said Charlotte, who stood behind her desk, papers spread out before her on the surface. "I spoke to you of it this summer, of what Ragnar Fell had reported to me about the Herringdales." Will pulled his fist from his trouser pockets and faced the consul angrily. "It was a joke to Mortmain, giving my family that house. He toyed with us. Why would he not extend the joke in this manner?" "Here, Josiah," said Charlotte, indicating one of the papers on the desk in front of her, "a map of Wales. There is a Lake Lynn in Idris, and here, Talith Lynn Lake at the foot of Curta Idris." "Lynn means lake," said Cecily in an exasperated tone, "and we call it Lynn Mungi, though some call it Talith Lynn."
"And there are probably other locations in the world with the name of Idris," snapped the consul, before he seemed to realize that he was arguing with a 15-year-old girl and subsided.
"But this one means something," Will said. "They see the lakes around the mountain are bottomless, that the mountain itself is hollow, and inside it sleep the Cumanuth, the hounds of the underworld."
"The Wild Hunt," said Charlotte.
"Yes," Will raked his dark hair back. "We are Nephilim. We believe in legends, in myths. All the stories are true. Where better than a hollow mountain already associated with dark magic and portents of death to hide himself and his contraptions? No one would find it odd if strange noises came from the mountain, and no locals would investigate. Why else would he even be in that area? I always wondered why he took a particular interest in my family. Maybe it was simple proximity, the opportunity to devil a Nephilim family. He would have been unable to resist it." The consul was leaning against the desk, his eyes on the map beneath Charlotte's hands.
"Which is not enough."
"Not enough? Not enough for what?" Cecily cried.
"To convince the Clave," the consul stood. "Charlotte, you will understand. To launch a force against Mortmain on the assumption that he's in Wales, we will have to convene a council meeting. We cannot take a small force from risk being outnumbered, especially by those creatures. How many of them were there this morning when you were attacked?"
6 or 7, not counting the creature that seized Tessa," said Charlotte. "We believe they can fold in upon themselves, and therefore were able to fit within the small confines of a brown."
and I believe that Mortmain did not realize that Gabriel and Gideon Lightwood would be with you, and thus underestimated the numbers he would need. Otherwise, I suspect you might all be dead.
And the Lightwoods, muttered Will. I believe he underestimated Bridget. She carved those creatures up like a Christmas turkey.
The consul threw his hands up.
We have read Benedict Lightwood's papers. In them he states that Mortmain's stronghold is just outside London, and that Mortmain intends to send a force against the London enclave.
Benedict Lightwood was going rapidly insane when he wrote that, Charlotte interrupted. Does it seem likely Mortmain would have shared with him his true plans?
What next and next?
The consul's voice was snappish, but also deadly cold.
Benedict had no reason to lie in his own journals, Charlotte, which you should not have read. If you were not so convinced that you should know more than the council, you would have given them over immediately. Such displays of disobedience do not incline me to trust you. If you must, you can bring this issue of Wales up with the council when we meet in a fortnight.
A fortnight? Will's voice rose. He was pale, with splotches of red standing on his cheekbones. Tessa was taken today. She does not have a fortnight.
The Magister wanted her unharmed. You know that, Will, said Charlotte in a soft voice.
He also wants to marry her. Do you not think she would hate becoming his plaything more than she would hate death? She could be married by tomorrow.
And the devil it is she is, said the consul. One girl who is not Nephilim is not, cannot be our priority.
She is my priority, Will shouted. There was a silence. Cecily could hear the sound of the damp wood popping in the grate. The fog that smeared the windows was dark yellow, and the consul's face was cast in shadow. Finally.
I thought she was your parabatized fiancé, he said tightly. Not yours.
Will raised his chin. If she is Jem's fiancé, then I am duty-bound to guard her as if she were my own. That is what it means to be parabatai.
Oh, yes, the consul's voice dripped sarcasm. Such loyalty is commendable.
He shook his head.
Arendelle's as stubborn as rocks. As I remember when your father wanted to marry your mother. Nothing would dissuade him, though she was no candidate for ascension. I had hoped for more amenability in his children.
You'll forgive my sister and myself if we do not agree, said Will, considering that if my father had been more amenable, as you say, we would not exist. The consul shook his head.
This is war, he said, not a rescue.
She's not just a girl, said Charlotte. She's a weapon in the hands of the enemy. I am telling you, Mortmain intends to use her against us.
Enough!
The consul lifted his overcoat from the back of the chair and shrugged himself into it.
This is a profitless conversation. Charlotte, see to your shadow hunters.
His gaze swept over Will and Cecily.
They seem overexcited.
I see that we cannot force your cooperation, consul. Charlotte's face was like thunder. But remember that I will put it on record that we warned you of this situation. If in the end we were correct and disaster comes from this delay, all the results will be on your head.
Cecily expected the consul to look angry, but he only flipped up his hood, hiding his features.
That is what it means to be consul, Charlotte.
Blood. Blood on the flagstones of the courtyard. Blood staining the stairs of the house. Blood on the leaves of the garden, the remains of what had once been Gabriel's brother-in-law. Lying in thick pools of drying blood, hot jets of blood splattering Gabriel's gear as the arrow he had released drove into his father's eye.
Regretting your decision to remain at the Institute, Gabriel.
The cool, familiar voice cut through Gabriel's feverish thoughts, and he looked up with a gasp.
The consul stood over him, outlined by weak sunlight. He wore a heavy overcoat, gloves, and an expression as if Gabriel had done something to amuse him.
Gabriel caught his breath, forced the words to come out evenly. No, of course not.
The consul quirked an eyebrow.
That must be why you are crouching here, around the side of the church, in blood-stained clothes, looking as if you're terrified someone might find you.
Gabriel scrambled to his feet, grateful for the hard stone wall behind him, bearing him up. He glared at the consul.
Are you suggesting that I did not fight? That I ran away?
I am not suggesting any such thing,
said the consul mildly.
I know that you stayed. I know that your brother was injured.
Gabriel took a sharp, rattling breath, and the consul's eyes narrowed.
Ah, he said. So that is it, isn't it? You saw your father die, and you thought you were going to see your brother die as well.
Gabriel wanted to scrabble at the wall behind him. He wanted to hit the consul in his unctuous, falsely sympathetic face. He wanted to run upstairs and throw himself down by his brother's bed, refuse to leave, as Will had refused to leave Jem until Gabriel had forced him away. Will was a better brother to Jem than he himself was to Gideon, he thought bitterly, and there was no blood shared between them. It was that, in part, that had driven him back out of the Institute, to his hiding space beneath the stables. Surely no one would look for him here, he told himself. He had been wrong. But he was wrong so often. What was one more time?
You saw your brother bleed, said the consul, still in the same mild voice. And you remembered.
I killed my father, Gabriel said. I put an arrow through his eye. I spilled his blood. Do you think I do not know what that means? His blood will cry to me from the ground, as Abel's blood called to Cain. Everyone says he wasn't my father any more, but he was still all that remained of him. He was a Lightwood once, and Gideon could have been killed today, to lose him as well.
You see what I meant, said the consul, when I spoke of Charlotte and her refusal to obey the law. The cost of life it engenders. It could have been your brother's life sacrificed to her overweening pride.
She does not seem proud.
Is that why you wrote this?
The consul drew from his coat pocket the first letter Gabriel and Gideon had sent him. He looked at it in contempt and let it flutter to the ground.
This ridiculous missive, calculated to annoy me.
Did it work? For a moment Gabriel thought the consul was going to hit him, but the look of anger passed quickly from the older man's eyes when he spoke again. It was calmly.
I suppose I should not have expected a Lightwood to react well to being blackmailed. Your father would not have. I confess I thought you of weaker stuff.
If you intend to try another avenue to persuade me, do not bother, Gabriel said. There is no point in it.
Really? You're that loyal to Charlotte Branwell after all her family did to yours. Gideon, I might have expected this from. He takes after your mother. Too trusting in nature, but not you, Gabriel. From you I expected more pride in your blood.
Gabriel let his head fall back against the wall. There was nothing, he said. You understand. There was nothing in Charlotte's correspondence to interest you, to interest anyone. You told us you would destroy us utterly if we did not report on her activities, but there was nothing to report on. You gave us no choice.
You could have told me the truth.
You did not want to hear it, said Gabriel. I am not stupid, and neither is my brother. You want Charlotte removed as head of the Institute, but you do not want it to be too clear that it was your hand that removed her. You wished to discover her engaged in some sort of illegal dealing, but the truth is there is nothing to be discovered.
Truth is malleable. Truth can be uncovered, certainly, but it can also be created.
Gabriel's gaze snapped to the consul's face. You would rather I lied to you?
Oh, no, said the consul. Not to me.
He put his hand on Gabriel's shoulder.
The Lightwoods have always had honor. Your father made mistakes. You should not have to pay for them. Let me give you back what you have lost. Let me return to you Lightwood House, the good name of your family. You could live in the house with your brother and sister. You need no longer be dependent on the charity of the Enclave.
Charity. The word was bitter. Gabriel thought of his brother's blood on the flagstones of the Institute. Had Charlotte not been so foolish, so determined to take the shape-changer girl into the bosom of the Institute against the objections of the Clave and Council, the Magister would not have sent his forces against the Institute. Gideon's blood would not have been spilled. In fact, whispered a small voice at the back of his mind, had it not been for Charlotte, my father's secret would have remained a secret. Benedict would not have been forced to betray the Magister. he would not have lost the source of the drug that held off the Astriola. He might never have transformed. His sons might never have learned of his sins. The Lightwoods could have continued in blissful ignorance.
Gabriel, said the consul, this offer is for you only. It must be kept a secret from your brother. He is like your mother, too loyal, loyal to Charlotte. His mistake and loyalty may do him credit, but it will not help us here. Tell him that I grew tired of your antics. Tell him that I no longer desire any action from you. You are a good liar.
Here he smiled sourly.
And I feel sure you can convince him. What do you say?
Gabriel set his jaw. What do you wish me to do? Will shifted the armchair by the side of Jem's bed. He had been here for hours now, and his back was growing stiff, but he refused to move. There was always the chance that Jem might wake and expect him there. At least it was not cold. Bridget had built up the fire in the grate. The damp wood popped and crackled, sending up the occasional blaze of sparks. The night outside the windows was dark without a hint of blue or clouds, only a flat black, as if it had been painted on the glass. Jem's violin leaned against the foot of his bed, and his cane, still slicked with blood from the fight in the courtyard, lay beside it. Jem himself lay still, propped up on pillows, no colour in his pale face. Will felt as if he was seeing him for the first time after a long absence, for that brief moment when you were apt to notice changes in familiar faces before they became part of the scenery of one's life once again. Jem looked so thin. How had Will not noticed? All extra flesh stripped away from the bones of cheeks and jaw and forehead, so he was all hollows and angles. There was a faint bluish sheen to his closed eyelids and to his mouth. His collarbones curved like the prow of a ship. Will upbraided himself. How had he not realized all these months that Jem was dying? So quickly. So soon. How had he not seen the scythe and the shadow? Will. It was a whisper at the door. He looked up dully and saw Charlotte there, her head around the doorway. There is someone here to see you. Will blinked as Charlotte moved out of the way and Magnus Baines stepped around her and into the room. For a moment, Will could think of nothing to say. He says you summoned him, Charlotte said, sounding a little dubious. Magnus stood, looking indifferent in a charcoal grey suit. He was slowly rolling his gloves, dark grey kid, off his thin brown hands. I did summon him, Will said, feeling as if he were waking up. Thank you, Charlotte. Charlotte gave him a look that mixed sympathy with the unspoken message. Be it on your head, Will Herondale. And went out of the room, closing the door conspicuously behind her. You came, Will said, aware that he sounded stupid. He never liked it when people observed the obvious aloud, and here he was doing just that. He could not shake his feelings of discombobulation. Seeing Magnus here, in the middle of Jem's bedroom, was like seeing a fairy knight seated among the white-wigged barristers of the Old Bailey. Magnus dropped his gloves on the top of the table and moved toward the bed. He put out a hand to brace himself against one of the posts as he looked down at Jem, so still and white that he could have been carved on top of a tomb. James Carstairs, he said, murmuring the words under his voice as if they had some incantatory power. He's dying, Will said. That much is evident. It could have sounded cold, but there were worlds of sadness in Magnus's voice, a sadness that Will felt with a jolt of familiarity. I thought you believed he had a few days. A week, perhaps. It's not just the lack of the drug. Will's voice sounded rusty. He cleared his throat. In fact, we have a little of that, and have administered it. But there was a fight this afternoon, and he lost blood and was weakened. He is not strong enough, we fear, to recover himself. Magnus reached out and with great gentleness lifted Jem's hand. There were bruises on his pale fingers, and the blue veins ran like a map of rivers under the skin of his wrist. Is he suffering? I don't know. Perhaps it would be better to let him die, Magnus looked at Will.
his eyes dark gold-green.
Every life is finite, Will, and you knew, when you chose him, that he would die before you did.
Will stared ahead of him. He felt as if he were hurtling down a dark tunnel, one that had no end, no sides to grip to slow his fall.
If you think that would be the best thing for him.
Will, Magnus's voice was gentle but urgent.
Did you bring me here because you hoped I could help him?
Will looked up blindly.
I don't know why I summoned you, he said. I don't think it was because I believed there was anything you could do. I think rather I thought you were the only one who might understand.
Magnus looked surprised.
The only one who might understand? You have lived so long, Will said. You must have seen so many die, so many that you loved. And yet you survive and you go on.
Magnus continued to look astonished.
You summoned me here, a warlock to the Institute, just after a battle in which you were nearly all killed, to talk. I find you easy to talk to, Will said. I cannot say why.
Magnus shook his head slowly and leaned against the post of the bed.
You are so young, he murmured. But then again, I do not think a Shadowhunter has ever called upon me before simply to pass the watches of the night with him. I don't know what to do, Will said. Mortmain has taken Tessa, and I believe now I know where she might be. There is a part of me that wants nothing more than to go after her. But I cannot leave Jem, I swore an oath. And what if he wakes in the night and finds I'm not here?
He looked as lost as a child. He will think I had left him willingly, not caring that he was dying. He will not know. And yet if he could speak, would he not tell me to go after Tessa? Is that not what he would want?
Will dropped his face into his hands.
I cannot say, and it is tearing me in half.
Magnus looked at him silently for a long moment. Does he know you're in love with Tessa?
No.
Will lifted his face, shocked.
No. I have never said a word. It was not his burden to bear.
Magnus took a deep breath and spoke gently.
Will, you asked me for my wisdom as someone who has lived many lifetimes and buried many loves. I can tell you that the end of a life is the sum of the love that was lived in it, that whatever you think you have sworn, being here at the end of Jem's life is not what is important. It was being here for every other moment. Since you met him, you have never left him and never not loved him. That is what matters.
You really mean that? Will said wonderingly. And then, why are you being so kind to me? I owe you a favor still, don't I? I remember that, you know, though you have never called it in.
Haven't I? Magnus said and then smiled at him.
Will, you treat me as a human being, a person like yourself. Rare is the Shadow Hunter who treats a warlock like that. I'm not so heartless that I would call in a favor from a broken-hearted boy, one who I think, by the way, will be a very good man some day. So I will tell you this. I will stay here when you go, and I will watch over your Jem for you, and if he wakes, I will tell him where you went, and that it was for him. And I will do what I can to preserve his life. I do not have any Yin Fen, but I do have magic, and perhaps there is something in an old spellbook I might find that can help him.
I would count it a great favor, Will said.
Magnus stood looking down at Jem.
There was sadness etched on his face, that face that was usually so merry or sardonic or uncaring, a sadness that surprised Will.
For whence had that former sorrow so easily penetrated to the quick, but that I had poured out my soul upon the dust in loving one who must die? Magnus said.
Will looked up at him.
What was that?
Confessions of St. Augustine, said Magnus.
You ask me how I, being immortal, survive so many deaths. There is no great secret. You endure what is unbearable, and you bear it. That is all.
He drew away from the bed. I will give you a moment alone with him,
to say goodbye as you need. You can find me in the library. Will nodded, speechless, as Magnus went to retrieve his gloves and then turned and left the room. Will's mind was spinning. He looked again at Jem, motionless in the bed. I must accept that this is the end, he thought, and even his thoughts felt hollow and distant. I must accept that Jem will never look at me, never speak to me again. You endure what is unbearable, and you bear it. That is all. And yet it still did not seem real to him, as if it were a dream. He stood up and leaned over Jem's still form. He touched his paralyzed cheek lightly. It was cold. Atque in perpetuam, frate, ave atque vale, he whispered, the words of the poem that had never seemed so fitting. Forever and ever, my brother, hail and farewell. Will began to straighten up, to turn away from the bed, and as he did, he felt something wrapped tightly around his wrist. He glanced down and saw Jem's hand braceleting his own. For a moment he was too shocked to do anything but stare. I'm not dead yet, Will, Jem said in a soft voice, thin but as strong as wire. What did Magnus mean by asking you if I knew you were in love with Tessa? Chapter 11. Fearful of the Night. Though my soul may set in darkness, it will rise in perfect light. I have loved the stars too fondly to be fearful of the night. Sarah Williams, The Old Astronomer. Will. After so much time of silence of only Jem's breaths raggedly in and out, Will thought for a moment he was imagining it, his best friend's voice speaking to him out of the dimness. As Jem released his grip on Will's wrist, Will sank into the armchair beside the bed. His heart was pounding, half with the relief and half with the sickly dread. Jem turned his head toward him against the pillow. His eyes were dark, their silver swallowed up by black. For a moment, the two young men just stared at each other. It was like the calm just as one engaged in a battle, Will thought, when thought fled and inevitability took over. Well, Jem said again, and coughed, pressing his hand to his mouth. When he took it away, there was blood on his fingers. Did I? Have I been dreaming? Will started upright. Jem had sounded so clear, so sure. What did Magnus mean by asking you if I knew you were in love with Tessa? But it was as if that burst of strength had fled from him, and he sounded dizzy and bewildered. Had Jem really heard what Magnus had said to him? And if he had, was there any chance it could be passed off as a dream, a feverish hallucination? The thought filled Will with a mixture of relief and disappointment. Dream what? Jem looked down at his bloody hand and slowly closed it into a fist. The fight in the courtyard. Jessamine's death. And they took her, didn't they? Tessa. Yes, Will whispered. And he'd repeated the words Charlotte had said to him earlier. They had brought him no comfort, but perhaps they would to Jem. Yes, but I don't think they'll hurt her. Remember, Mortmain desired her unhurt. We must find her. You know that, Will. We must. Jem struggled into a sitting position and immediately began to cough again. Blood spattered the white coverlet. Will held Jem's frail and shaking shoulders until the coughing ceased to rack his frame, and then took one of the damp cloths from the bedside table and began to clean Jem's hands. When he reached to wipe the blood from his paralyzed face, Jem took the cloth gently from his grasp and looked at him gravely. I'm not a child, Will. I know. Will drew his hand back. He had not cleaned them since the fight in the courtyard, and Jessamine's dried blood mixed with Jem's fresh blood on his fingers. Jem took a deep breath. Both he and Will waited to see if it would produce another spasm of coughing, and when it did not, Jem spoke. Magnus said you were in love with Tessa. Is it true? Yes, Will said, with a feeling that he was falling off a cliff. Yes, it's true.
Jem's eyes were wide and luminous in the darkness.
Does she love you?
No.
Will's voice cracked. I told her I loved her, and she never wavered from you. It is you she loves.
Jem's death grip on the cloth in his hands relaxed slightly.
You told her, he said, that you were in love with her. Jem, when was this, and what excess of desperation could have driven you?
It was before I knew you were engaged. It was the day I discovered there was no curse on me.
Will spoke haltingly. I went to Tessa and I told her that I loved her. She was as kind as she could be in telling me that she loved you and not me, and that you two were engaged.
Will dropped his gaze.
I do not know if this will make any difference to you, James, but I truly had no idea that you cared for her. I was entirely obsessed with my own emotions.
Jem bit his lower lip, bringing color to the white skin.
And forgive me for asking this. It is not a passing fancy, a transient regard.
He broke off, looking at Will's face.
No, he murmured. I can see that it is not. I love her enough that when she assured me that she would be happy with you, I swore to myself I would never speak of my desires again. Never indicate my regard by any word or by gesture. Never by action or speech violate her happiness. My feelings have not changed, and yet I care enough for her and for you that I would not say a word to threaten what you have found. The words spilled from Will's lips. There seemed no reason to keep them back. If Jem was going to hate him, he would hate him for the truth and not a lie.
Jem looked stricken.
I'm so sorry, Will. So very, very sorry. I wish that I had known.
Will slumped down in the chair.
What could you have done? I could have called off the engagement. Unbroken both your hearts.
How would that have benefited me? You are as dear to me as another half of my soul, Jem.
I could not be happy while you were unhappy. And Tessa, she loves you. What sort of awful monster would I be, delighting in causing the two people I love the most in the world agony, simply that I might have the satisfaction of knowing that if Tessa could not be mine, she could not be anybody's.
But you are my parabatai. If you are in pain, I wish to lessen it.
This, Will said, is the one thing you cannot give me comfort for.
Jem shook his head.
But how could I not have noticed? I told you, I saw that the walls about your heart were coming down. I thought I knew why. I told you I always knew you carried a burden, and I knew you had gone to see Magnus. I thought perhaps you had made some use of his magic to free yourself from some imaginary guilt. If I had ever known it was because of Tessa, you must know, Will, I would never have made my feelings known to her.
How could you have guessed? Miserable though Will was, he felt free, as if a heavy burden had been displaced from him. I did all I could to hide and deny it.
You never hid your feelings, and looking back it was clear and plain, and yet I never saw it. I was astonished when Tessa told me that you were engaged. You've always been the source in my life of such good things, James. I never thought you'd be the source of pain. And so, wrongly, I never thought of your feelings at all. And that is why I was so blind.
Jem closed his eyes. The lids were blue-shadowed, parchment-like.
I am grieved for your pain, he said. But I'm glad that you love her.
You are glad?
It makes it easier, Jem said, to ask you to do what I wish you to do. Leave me. And go after Tessa.
Now? Like this?
Jem, incredibly, smiled.
Is that not what you were doing when I caught at your hand?
But I did not believe you would regain consciousness. This is different. I cannot leave you like this, not to face alone whatever you must face.
Jem's hand came up, and for a moment, Will thought he was going to reach for Will's hand. but he knotted his fingers in the material of his friend's sleeve instead.
"You are my parabatai," he said. "You have said I could ask anything of you. But I swore to stay with you. If aught but death part thee and me, death will part us."
"You know the words of the oath come from a longer passage," Will said. "Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go." Jem cried out with his remaining strength,
"You cannot go where I'm going, nor would I want that for you. Neither can I walk away and leave you to die."
There, Will had said it, said the word, admitted the possibility. Die.
"No one else can be trusted with this."
Jem's eyes were bright, feverish, almost wild.
"Do you think I do not know that if you do not go after her, no one will? Do you think it doesn't kill me that I cannot go, or at least go with you?"
He leaned toward Will. His skin was as pale as the frosted glass of a lampshade, and like such a lamp, light seemed to shine through him from some inner source. He slid his hands across the coverlet.
"Take my hands, Will."
Numbly, Will closed his hands around Jem's. He imagined he could feel a flicker of pain in the parabatai rune on his chest, as if it knew what he did not, and was warning him of coming pain, a pain so great he did not imagine he could bear it and live.
"Jem is my great sin," he had told Magnus, and this, now, was the punishment for it.
He had thought losing Tessa was his penance. He had not thought of how it would be when he had lost both of them.
"Well," Jem said, "for all these years I have tried to give you what you could not give yourself."
Will's hands tightened on Jem's, which were as thin as a bundle of twigs.
"And what is that?"
"Faith," said Jem,
"that you were better than you thought you were. Forgiveness that you need not always punish yourself. I always loved you, Will, whatever you did. And now I need you to do for me what I cannot do for myself. For you to be my eyes when I do not have them. For you to be my hands when I cannot use my own. For you to be my heart when mine is done with beating."
"No," said Will wildly. "No, no, no. I will not be those things.
Your eyes will see. Your hands will feel. Your heart will continue to beat."
"But if not, Will,
if I could tear myself in half, I would, that half of me might remain with you and half follow Tessa."
"Half of you would be no good to either of us," said Jem. "There is no other I could trust to go after her. No other who would give of his own life, as I would, to save hers. I would have asked you to undertake this mission, even if I had not known your feelings. But being certain that you love her as I do,
Will, I trust you above all, and I believe in you above all, knowing that as always your heart is twinned with mine in this matter."
"Woman xie, jie bai sheng di."
"We are more than brothers, Will. Undertake this journey, and you undertake it not for yourself alone, but for both of us."
"I cannot leave you to face death alone," Will whispered. But he knew he was beaten. The sands of his will had run out. Jem touched the parabatai rune on his shoulder through the thin material of his nightshirt.
"I am not alone," he said. "Wherever we are as one."
Will rose slowly to his feet. He could not believe he was doing what he was doing, but it was clear that he was, as clear as the silver rim around the black of Jem's eyes.
"If there is a life after this one," he said, "let me meet you in it, James Carstairs." "There will be other lives."
Jem held his hand out, and for a moment they clasped hands, as they had done during their parabatai ritual, reaching across twin rings of fire to interlace their fingers with each other.
"The world is a wheel," he said. "When we rise or fall, we do it together."
Will tightened his grip on Jem's hand.
"Well then," he said, through a tight throat, "since you say there will be another life for me,
let us both pray I do not make as colossal a mess of it as I have this one." Jem smiled at him, that smile that had always, even on Will's blackest days, eased his mind.
"I think there is hope for you yet, Well, Herondale, I will try to learn how to have it without you to show me.
Tessa, Jem said.
She knows despair and hope as well. You can teach each other. Find her, Will. Tell her that I loved her always. My blessing, for all that it is worth, is on you both.
Their eyes met and held. Will could not bring himself to say goodbye, or to say anything at all. He only gripped Jem's hand one last time and released it, and then turned and walked out the door.
The horses were stabled out behind the Institute, Cyril's territory during the daytime, where the rest of them rarely ventured. The stable had once been an old parish house, and the floor was of uneven stone, swept scrupulously clean. Stalls lined the walls, though only two were occupied, one by Balios and the other by Xanthos, both fast asleep, with their tails switching slightly in the manner of dreaming equines. Their mangers were packed with fresh hay, and shining tacked lined the walls, polished to bright perfection. Will determined that if he should return from his mission alive, he would make sure to tell Charlotte that Cyril was doing an excellent job. Will woke Balios with gentle murmurings and drew him from his stall. He had been taught to saddle and bridle a horse as a boy before he had ever come to the Institute, and so he let his mind wander as he did it now, running the stirrups up the leathers, checking both sides of the saddle, reaching carefully beneath Balios to capture the cinch. He had left no notes behind him, no messages for anyone in the Institute. Jem would tell them where he had gone, and Will had found that now, in this time when he most needed the words he usually found so easily, he could not reach them. He could not quite conceive that he might be saying goodbye, and so he ran over and over in his mind what he had packed in the saddlebags. Gear, a clean shirt and collar, who knew when he might need to look like a gentleman. Two steelies, all the weapons that would fit, bread, cheese, dried fruit, and mundane money. As Will fastened the cinch, Balios lifted his head and whickered. Will's head whipped around, a slight feminine figure stood in the doorway of the stable. As Will stared, she raised her right hand and a witchlight in it flared up, illuminating her face. It was Cecily, a blue velvet cloak wrapped around her, her dark hair loose and free around her face. Her feet were bare, peeking out beneath the hem of the cloak. He straightened up. "Ceci, what are you doing here?" She took a step forward, then paused on the threshold, glancing down at her bare feet.
"I could ask you the same."
"I like to talk to the horses at night. They make good company. And you should not be out about in your nightgown. There are lightwoods wandering these halls."
"Very funny.
Where are you going, Will? If you're going to seek Mor Yim Fen, take me with you." "I am not going to seek Mor Yim Fen." Understanding dawned in her blue eyes.
"You're going after Tessa. You're going to Cad Idris."
Will nodded.
"Take me," she said. "Take me with you, Will."
Will could not look at her. He went to get the bit and bridle, though his hands shook as he took them down and turned them back to Balios.
"I cannot take you with me. You cannot ride Xanthos. You have not the training, and an ordinary horse would only slow our journey down.
The carriage horses are automatons. You cannot hope to catch them up."
"I do not expect to.
Balios may be the fastest horse in England, but he must rest and sleep. I am already resigned. I shall not reach Tessa on the road. I can only hope to arrive at Cad Idris before it is too late."
"Then let me ride after you, and do not worry if you outpace me."
"Be reasonable, Ceci."
"Reasonable," she flared. "All I see is my brother going away from me again. It's been years, Will, years. I came to London to find you, and now that we are here together again, you are leaving."
Balios stirred uneasily as Will fitted the bit into his mouth and slid the bridle up over his head. Balios did not like shouting. Will gentled him with a hand on his neck.
"Will," Cecily sounded dangerous, "look at me, or I shall go wake the household and stop you. I swear that I will."
Will leaned his head against the horse's neck and closed his eyes. He could smell hay and horse, and cloth and sweat, and some of the sweet scent of smoke that still clung to his clothes from the fire in Jem's room.
"Cecily," he said, I need to know that you are here, and as safe as you can be, or I cannot leave. I cannot fear for Tessa ahead on the road, and you behind me, or the fear will break me down. Already too many that I love are in danger.
There was a long silence. Will could hear the beat of Balios's heart under his ear, but nothing else. He wondered if Cecily had left, walked out while he was speaking, perhaps to rouse the household. He lifted his head. But no. Cecily was standing where she had been, the witchlight burning in her hand.
"Tessa said you called out for me once," she said, "when you were ill."
"Why me, Will?"
"Cecily." The word was a soft exhale. "For years you were my talisman. I thought I'd killed Ella. I left Wales to keep you safe. As long as I could imagine you thriving and happy and well, the pain of missing you and Mother and Father was worth it."
"I never understood why you left," Cecily said, "and I thought the Shadow Hunters were monsters. I could not understand why you'd come here, and I always thought, that when I was old enough, I would come and pretend I wished to be a Shadow Hunter myself, until I could convince you to come home. When I learned of the curse, I did not know what to think any more. I understood why you had come, but not why you had stayed."
"Jem."
"But even if he dies," she said, and he flinched, "you will not come home to Mam and Dad, will you? You are a Shadow Hunter through and through, as Father never was. It is why you've been so stubborn about writing to them. You do not know how to both ask forgiveness and also say that you are not coming home."
"I cannot come home, Cecily. Or at least, it is not my home any longer. I am a Shadow Hunter. It is in my blood."
"You know I'm your sister, do you not?" she said. "It is also in my blood."
"You said you were pretending."
He searched her face for a moment and said slowly, "But you are not, are you? I've seen you training, fighting. You feel it as I did. As if the floor of the Institute is the first really solid ground under your feet. As if you have found the place you belong. You are a Shadow Hunter." Cecily said nothing. Will felt his mouth twist into a sideways smile.
"I am glad," he said. "Glad there will be a Herondale in the Institute.
Even if you do not come back. Will, let me come with you. Let me help you."
"No, Cecily. Is it not enough that I accept that you will choose this life? A life of fighting and danger, though I have always wanted a greater safety for you.
No. I cannot let you come with me, even if you hate me for it."
Cecily sighed.
"Don't be so dramatic, Will. Must you always insist that people hate you when they obviously don't?"
"I am dramatic," said Will. "If I had not been a Shadow Hunter, I would have had a future on the stage. I have no doubt I would have been greeted with acclaim." Cecily did not appear to find this amusing. Will supposed he could not blame her.
"I'm not interested in your rendition of Hamlet," she said. "If you're not going to let me go with you, then promise me that if you go now, promise me that you will come back."
"I cannot promise that," Will said. "But if I can come back to you, I will. And if I do come back, I will write to Mother and Father. I can promise that much."
"No," said Cecily. "No letters. Promise me that if you do come back, you will return to Mother and Father with me and tell them why you left, and that you do not blame them, and that you love them still. I do not ask you go home to stay. Neither you nor I can ever go home to stay. But to comfort them is little enough to ask. Do not tell me that it is against the rules, Will, because I know all too well that you enjoy breaking those."
"See," Will asked, "you do know your brother a little, after all. I give you my word that if all those conditions are met, I will do as you ask." Her shoulders and face relaxed. She looked small and defenseless with her anger gone, though he knew she was not. "And Cersei," he said softly, "before I go, I wish to give you one more thing." He reached into his shirt and lifted over his head the necklace Magnus had given him. It swung, gleaming rich ruby red in the dim lights of the stables.
"Your lady's necklace," Cecily said.
"Well, I confess, it does not suit you."
He stepped towards Cecily and drew the glittering chain over her dark head. The ruby fell against her throat as if it were made for her.
She looked at him over it, her eyes serious.
Wear it always. It will warn you when demons are coming, Will said. It will help keep you safe.